Hey everyone, John here. Just a quick word of warning. We will be spoiling this film in its entirety. So if you have not seen this film and you don't want it spoiled for you, just hit pause real quick and go and watch the movie and then come back and enjoy the show.
We got special work to do here, you and me. You've got the body. I've got the brain.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Surviving Chick Flicks, Pride Month edition. This is one of the 3 months I somehow get some kind of Machiavellian control over the show.
Yeah, I'm still opposed to this.
Excuse me?
No. I just think that it's funny that you choose this month to be sexist and not let the woman have a choice or a say in the matter. You know, last year, I think we actually did split it up evenly. I think, or not evenly, but I do think I had a pick or two.
Actually, you didn't. I seem to remember we had a meeting at the beginning of the year where we laid out the schedule, and I just said, what do you think, guys think? And I sort of, okay, I may have guided you along a little bit, but at least one movie someone else picked.
Well, I know, because I know last year Brokeback Mountain was my pick, and Milk might have also been, or it might have been yours, that one I can't remember, but I know Brokeback Mountain was mine.
You know what, maybe so, maybe you're right.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I have slept and not slept since then, so.
I could be wrong.
Yeah. But, well, I know you were a fan of doing, a proponent of doing Brokeback Mountain last year, and there was little to no, Milk was the manly movie of the month.
It was.
Because I also made y'all, I think that was a joint effort, because I also made y'all watch The Times of Harvey Milk.
Right,
and at least one, yeah, and at least one of y'all did that.
This is true.
But we're not doing anything as classy as Brokeback Mountain or Milk this week. We are doing a movie that I've actually wanted to talk about for a long time. And it is now considered a queer horror classic, but this week we are talking about A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, which is going to lead into God knows what's happening in July, Sammy's Revenge.
I still got a month to think about it.
You do, and that's what scares me. Because definitely nothing in this movie scared me.
No, nothing scared me. Maybe the acting a little bit in some areas, but that's about it.
Yeah.
The script, well, we have to, the acting.
The script, the soundtrack. Well, that's something we'll come to. But why don't we play the trailer and then we'll get into what I'm sure is a lively discussion.
Someone is coming back to Elm Street. He is not friendly. He is not patient.
Kill for me.
And he is not a welcome visitor. But he has something terribly special for the new kid on the block.
It started to happen again.
Dad!
I'm in trouble. You've had some scary dreams, okay?
Help!
Daddy can't help you now.
There's something inside him.
Fight him! You're not afraid of him. He doesn't even exist.
Freddy Krueger is back on Elm Street. Watch out for him. He'll be in your neighborhood soon. A Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 2.
You are all my children now.
Freddy's Revenge.
All right. right, A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, starring Mark Patton, Kim Myers, Robert Ressler, I can never pronounce Clue's last name, Gulager, Academy Award nominee Hope Lang, Robert Englund, an uncredited Bob Shea, and directed by Jack Shoulder.
I have a different answer that might shock some people this week. 72 hours ago?
We have tripled the length of time.
You know, to be fair, I feel like a big point of this show was for us to talk about movies and also, like, expose each other to film that we probably otherwise would have never chosen to watch on our own. So, you know, I sort of feel like we're doing our jobs.
While I agree slightly, they both have good films and god-awful films.
Oh, well, yes.
So, Joseph, why don't you answer the question real quick?
I don't remember the exact time I watched it, because this movie came out before I was able to really watch it. I think it came out like a few days before I was born, actually.
Let's see. This film came out November 1st, 1985. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. It came out 1985.
So it came out like 7 days before I was born. I want to say I was like 12, maybe 13 when I first saw it, because I was getting into horror.
Mm-hmm. And
I watched the first one. I was like, oh, wait, there's more of these? And they're like, yeah, there's more of them. And it's like, yeah, watch at your own discretion.
Yeah. Some are not as good as some others.
But I remember liking this when I first saw it. Of course, yeah. I didn't pick up on any of the quote-unquote subtext at the time. We'll I just knew some that. Things were a little
we're
off.
Getting to that.
But, yes, which we have discussed. It's subtext is not the right word. It text is.
We will get to that. Yeah.
But I still enjoy it. I think it's a really good movie to talk about right now.
Yeah. Okay, so I don't exactly know when I saw this, but I know I was about 7-ish years old when I first saw my first Nightmare on Elm Street film, which is the third one, which is the superior one to the entire franchise. And slowly but surely over the next few years, I got caught up all the way through the sixth one. I remember the sixth film coming out because Freddy was dead. There were going to be no more three films later. We are at a standstill. But I remember Freddy Krueger as the pop culture icon. I mean, he was... there were masks and toys and shit marketed to kids for... stuff that was, you know, started off as not so child friendly. But
oh, they think Looney Tunes movie for a couple.
I remember begging my mom to let me go see Freddy's Dead, and in a way, I kind of owe her a thank you for saying no. The only regret is I didn't get to see the awful Dream Snakes in 3D. Woo. So, but somewhere, I don't think I watched them in order, because obviously starting with the third one, and then maybe the first, and then just kind of filled in the gaps as they went along. I do remember watching this one and having vivid memories of going, well, that one was a little different.
I can't say for sure, it's really hard, but because, you know, you guys had told me sort of what to expect going into the film. So it does make me curious. I wonder if I had known if I would have had the same, if I would have picked up on it as quickly.
God, I hope so.
Well, I mean, to a degree, yeah, a lot of it's obvious, but as we're going to discuss, he was very straight passing in this film. It's the film itself that has all this kind of innuendo, but I wouldn't have thought anything about the character.
David Chaskin, who is the writer of this film, I don't know where his mindset was, and because there's no Wikipedia article for this man, I don't know if Chaskin is straight or gay. I know that whenever he wrote this movie, he put in a lot of what he claimed was homosexual subtext. And to anyone with a vision, you know, with like vision and hearing and, you know, their working senses. It's not subtext. It just feels like absolute text.
Sometimes it's literal text.
Yeah. Over the years, this film was kind of like, they would call it gay as a dig, but over the years, the queer community has absolutely embraced this film, and this is now considered a gay horror classic. And, you know, and I kind of agree, because it's an incredibly unique film. And it's certainly maybe the most unique in all of the Elm Street franchise, because anything before this movie and anything after this movie never references this. This is an outlier in the franchise. I actually rewatched the first one last night because I had time to watch both. And I almost watched the third one as well, but, you know, sleep got in the way. Even though I know you're never supposed to fall asleep. But thank you for the pity chuckle.
Did he mention why he wanted to put homosexual subtext in the film? Was there like a particular reason?
I don't know. I know he talked about, there are two documentaries about this, and I almost wanted to talk about them later, but the first one I'll address is a film called Never Sleep Again, and it's a four-hour documentary about the Elm Street franchise, where it came from and where it went. And it's a really great documentary if you like, you know, if you like documentaries about films. This and Crystal Lake Memories, which is a 7-hour film about the Friday the 13th franchise.
Yeah, because they really into these movies.
And it's like in depth. I would love to get my hands on a copy of the Crystal Lake Memories book, but shit's expensive. But I know he said it was subtext. And we're going to get into, maybe a little bit later, to Mark Patton and his career a little bit later. But real quick, let's give him a plot synopsis and then we'll talk about the actual film. The film is set, I actually wrote a thing. It's been 5 years since the fight between Nancy Thompson and nightmarish child killer Freddy Krueger. Now the Thompson home has new owners, the Walsh family. Jesse Walsh, the eldest child, has been having night terrors since they moved in, which begins to worry his family. After a fight with his classmate named Grady, played by Weird Science star Robert Ressler, now a veteran of two surviving chick flicks reviews, the pair become friends, and Jesse becomes the frequent target of sadistic Coach Schneider. Jesse is forced by his parents to finally unpack his room, and as he does so, his friend and love interest, Lisa, comes over, and the pair begin putting his room together and discovers a diary left behind by Nancy in Jesse's closet. The diary tells of Nancy's fight and nightmares featuring Fred Krueger. After a bird catches fire in the kitchen, Jesse tells Lisa about his dream, and the pair begin investigating Krueger's abandoned factory, but find nothing. The next night, Lisa throws a pool party where she makes a move on Jesse, only for him to freak out and run over to sleep with Grady. Freddy emerges from Jesse's body and kills Grady before changing back into Jesse, and Jesse escapes over to Lisa's house, only to once again change back into Freddy and attack the party. Freddy tries to attack Lisa, but Jesse is strong enough to stop him. Lisa's father tries to shoot Freddy, who escapes into a ball of flames. Lisa drives to the factory to confront Freddy, but when Lisa tells Jesse that she loves him, Jesse is able to fight back and defeat Freddy once and for all. And the pair go back to school, where their friend Carrie describes that the nightmare is over, only for Freddy's glove to burst through her chest, and the nightmare begins again. That's the movie.
Yeah, that's basically what happens.
So, like I said, this movie has like no connection to the franchise really at all, because the first Nightmare on Elm Street was a huge hit for New Line. In fact, New Line was always called the house that Freddy built. I mean, they existed for a while, and they were mostly doing stuff like they would organize like theatrical showings of Reefer Madness, and then got into lower budget indie films. They put out a lot of the early John Waters films. So stuff like Polyester were, you know, modest hits for them. And of course, you know, they got the rights to Pink Flamingos, which, you know, has been a midnight classic since, you know, it came out, for better or for worse. But Nightmare on Elm Street was like their first true like hit. And so they were jumping at the chance to make another one. And unfortunately, they did not know what they were doing. So much so that Robert Englund, who plays Freddy Krueger, for those five of you listening that don't know, he wasn't even originally brought back. A lot of the scenes, if Freddy's like in shadows or like fog, it's a stunt double. It wasn't until like halfway through production that they brought Robert Englund back, you know, to portray Freddy, which was...
Yeah, they didn't think he was pivotal for the role.
Yeah. And only for him to become, you know, the draw for so many people, because by the time 3 came out, he was still scary, but he was also starting to be a little bit more comedic. And by then, it was just like, we just want to see what Freddy's doing. We don't give a shit about these nameless teenagers.
Yeah, like I said, you can kind of see his personality coming through a little bit in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it really comes through in 3. That's where it really starts. Yeah. The Freddy Krueger, really know.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of the main criticism, like a lot of the fans had when this film came out, and for years to come, is that it broke the rules of what Freddy can do, because Freddy never really came into the real world, and he only attacked you in your dreams. He stayed in that realm. And he was never looking for... He was never trying to, you know, do whatever they did in Avatar and, find someone else's body to walk around in.
No. That's why it was a real, little bit weird. But I do like the idea of what they were going for.
Yeah.
No, this is one of the few ones that we actually did get to watch as a group.
Mm-hmm. So I did spend a lot of time watching Sammy's reaction.
Because I've seen this movie a lot.
You know,
so, yeah.
This movie would have been fine on its own, but I do think it was the type of movie that's more fun, like, with a group viewing experience. Because the first one was, like, not that this one wasn't, but the first one was a really well thought out, very well crafted film. This one was a little bit more...
thrown campy together?
Yeah, but that's okay. Like, I think the film knew what it was. I'm not sure the directors and writers, I don't know if it's exactly what they intended it to be, or it just kind of was a happy accident, but either way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to insult Jack Shoulder. I know his position for years is that he never saw this as a gay film. He just thought he was making a horror film. And, you know, that's a position he holds to this day. And I'm like, cool, but how did you not know?
Well, maybe making the film in pieces, you know, you don't see it the way somebody who's watching the film in its entirety sees it.
That is true. I mean, the kid from The Shining never knew he was making a horror film. I know we've referenced... the film Sallow on the show. All of the young people that were in that movie didn't know what an intense film they were making on, because they had spent the entire time on set laughing and joking. They didn't know it was like, you know, this really tense, fucked up thing until they got to the theater and saw it. It was like, oh shit. Because you know, sometimes it's easier not to know what you're making.
That's very
but. Cool. Yeah, and also this film came out, you know, in the middle of the 80s, you know, in the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. At this time, the president at the time still hadn't even said the word AIDS, even though one of his closest friends from Hollywood was dying from the disease. And it has gotten better, but there was a stigma even as far back as, you know, the middle of the 80s. Where people could have their careers ruined by being outed. And sadly, that's the case for our star here.
Yeah, and I don't think that was changed much until like the beginning of the 2000s started a little bit.
I would say definitely the era of like Will and Grace helped.
Mm-hmm.
There's a YouTube creator, Matt Baum, who just did a video about the effect Will and Grace had on queer rights and also queer visibility and just the effect it had on pop culture in general. Definitely worth checking out. And that came out after Ellen came out. So it was like Hollywood decided to look at queer characters and not just make them the villain of the movie and actually start telling stories about the community. There was some, there were some mistakes made, but things are so much better now that, I mean, now we even have animated shows for youngsters, that might be questioning who they are, and, we have way more visibility now. We are still not perfect, far from it, but it's slowly getting better.
Slowly.
Slowly.
Because I remember when stuff like that was happening when I was a kid, it was still one of those, depending on who you were, it could have still killed your career.
Yeah. So, speaking of Mark Patton, why don't we talk a little bit about him? This was the third film he ever made. He was a stage actor. He also did some TV, but he made his debut in a Robert Altman film that was an adaptation of a play called Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, where, and it was about three women in a five and dime store in the middle of Texas. I believe it was Texas. I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, but he played the one man that worked in the store, and he left, and whenever the character returns, had transitioned into a woman.
Hmm.
And this is a show that I believe he was in the original Broadway cast, and Robert Altman turned it into a film, and it kickstarted what could have been a fantastic career. Unfortunately, this film, and with the rise of the AIDS epidemic, with the fear of being outed, and because he was a gay man. Well, he was and still is a gay man. He's still alive. I'm Facebook friends with him. But this film took a toll on his career, and he didn't appear in anything again until the Never Sleep Again documentary in 2010. And Mark has a great documentary that he made recently called Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. And it talked about his career, how homophobia and AIDS paranoia and his sexuality really damaged his career. And he went off for years and he's now living in Mexico. He and his husband have an art, I think it's like an art store or gallery. And he's finally come to terms with his career, but he does have a confrontation with the screenwriter of this film. In the film.
Oh, really?
Because, in the documentary. And it's basically Mark getting closure. And it is a lot of, I don't remember this. And Mark is like, I vividly remember this. But Mark is in a much better place now. In fact, he's about to make a film with another surviving chick flicks, I guess, alum. But he's going to be doing a horror film with Alyssa Rose from Sammy's favorite film, Sleepaway Camp.
I was looking up here. He has six films that he's working on.
Yeah, he's... I think the fact that... And at the end, they're not dead by suicide or, cops, because he wasn't... Jesse was never punished for who he was, even though Jesse is probably a straight character.
I think most definitely.
Yeah. Even though he was trying his damnedest to not sleep with Lisa.
She was not giving up.
That's one of the things that completely got me about this film. I mean, I I guess maybe she kind of had enough to work with. But in the beginning, all she really had to go off was this diary from this girl that had previously lived there that people kind of thought was crazy. And so based off that, she kind of just believed that her boyfriend was being possessed by the spirit of this child murderer. As opposed to, all I'm saying is she put a lot of faith in her high school boyfriend and a diary from a potentially mentally ill.
Well, in defense of that, and well, in defense of all that, because you've only seen two Elm Street films to date, as far as I know, but Freddy Krueger wasn't necessarily a secret. The other films definitely expand upon that. Plus, a very fantastic TV series that's playing right now on Tubi, if you have, you know, the tolerance to deal with that. But, I mean, the adults of Springwood did try to suppress Fred Krueger mostly because they didn't want their kids to know, hey, we committed a frontier justice on a child killer, and you're welcome. Sweet dreams. But the it's like any secret, you know, on a mass scale, it's going to get out. And,
right. You know, but I mean,
Grady seemed to know a little bit about it before, or at least, you know, well, maybe pretended he didn't know that.
People really believe it, or it's just going to be like legend.
I think a little of column A, a little of column B. I think people are willing to push it off as legend until the creepy man in the red and green sweater starts showing up in their dreams, and it's like, okay, maybe there's something to this.
Yeah, because it really becomes more prominent in the later movies where that mythology kind of gets played with.
Yeah.
I still think the best thing that happened for him in this film was the fact that Freddy actually did come into the real world, which I understand it was like a little bit of a leap, sort of, but that saved him
a quantum leap, you might say.
The rest of his life in prison.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions to be raised by the end of this film. It's just like, mostly, what's the time gap in between the night of the party and the day they get back on the school bus? Because Jesse is very obvious. Been to a hospital for some injury treatment, but I want to know, it's like, how did he get, you know, exonerated or no charges filed on at least a series of, let's see, at least 4 to 5 murders. I was like, go ahead.
Since all those witnesses at the party saw Freddy, the assumption is just going to be that he did all the murders.
I mean, that is fair. Also, can we talk about the fact that nobody dies in this movie until, like, maybe about a half an hour in?
Yeah, it is a slow build.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you might say the build is almost as slow as Jesse unpacking his room.
That was a... Yeah. I have to say, though, that was a great scene.
Yeah, up until that scene, you were like, yeah, this movie's straight. No.
It's too early. It's too early. You're waiting too long.
Yeah. It's not until he starts dancing in his room. It's like, oh, there it is. Oh.
And that's like the thing. I was like, yeah, there's no subtext.
Yeah. When he's playing with a pop gun.
We've been over this. And I don't necessarily think that him playing a single album, you know, indicates his sexuality. I'm just saying.
I'm not.
Otherwise, Joseph has some explaining to do about it, more than a few Spice Girl albums.
I have to explain nothing to you.
I believe we explained that. We watched those videos with the sound off. That's on recording.
I did not say that. That was all John.
Two becomes one, slaps.
So for the spice up your life.
And now we've covered two of the three songs I can name. I guess when it comes to being a Spice Girls fan, I'm just a wannabe.
Oh gosh!
Now we have all three. But also the music he was listening to, and I know you can't necessarily stereotype people by their music because people from all walks of life like all different types of things. He was a teenage boy listening to something that would be probably played in a gay disco. Also, that song ended up being a hit.
It did.
Yeah, but what we heard was like a demo version of it. Apparently, it was re-recorded, and that song actually made someone like a hit, and I'm still amazed by that.
So, what do we think about the parents in this movie? Were they your typical horror film parents, or what?
They are not the typical anything parents. They are in a class all by themselves. I kind of love the dad in this movie, Clue Gulager, who his son directed the first Feast film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I believe Clue was in Return of the Living Dead. He's a horror icon. Like, not as beloved as, like, your Tom Atkins, but maybe on the next rung down. But it is a staple of horror films, especially in the 80s, to not listen to the children and not to take them seriously. But these parents were on a whole other level.
Oh, they were completely oblivious. Things were in front of them the whole time. They're like, this is nothing. Yeah. our son's stupid.
Yeah. Our son exploded a parakeet with a cherry bomb.
How did he do it? We don't know. He's weird. He's crazy.
It's like, what? Wouldn't the bird die with the insertion of the cherry bomb?
Well, you know, what are you, a scientist?
I'm no scientist. But I assume.
And another one is the coach. The coach, that was definitely a different character from what I'm used to seeing in a horror film.
Coach Schneider, the coach that hangs around S&M joints downtown and looks for pretty boys like Jesse.
See, the coach is the text.
Well, the coach is definitely, the coach knows who he is. He is secure in who he is, and he definitely has a kink. Also, points against the points deducted from the coach because he's trying to make his student his submissive, his possibly underage student.
Oh no, he's
There. You know, I kind of had an issue with that part of the film. Like, I don't know the point of it or what they were trying to get at, but that was seriously messed up. Meeting his coach in that club, and then his coach making him go back and run laps at the gym in the middle of the night.
Yeah, well,
all
I mean,
I'm saying is that that's one death I'm not entirely sure we were devastated by.
No,
it was completely deserved.
Yeah, and it's also, one of the two big effects moments in this film because, or really four, because I would say, the very end of the film, the very beginning of the film, whenever we're in Nightmare Land, the transformation in Grady's room and this, Schneider's death, where he's attacked by balls and ropes and displayed in the shower. Yeah, he had his kink turned on him and he paid the ultimate price. And we were like, cool.
Couldn't have happened to a better person.
Nope. And I think that was the death that whenever I first watched this film, that's when I was feeling that this one was different from the others. Because by this time, I had also seen at least the third one and the first one. So I had a kind of an idea of what Freddy could do. And then all this happened.
It's true. Because honestly, you could watch the first one and third one, and you wouldn't really have missed anything story.
Yeah, this is the Halloween 3 of the Freddy franchise.
But funnily enough, it kind of is, even though it does feature Freddy. Do not
compare this film by comparing it to Halloween 3.
Everyone's problem with Halloween 3 is the fact that it's called Halloween 3. If it was just an obscure 80s horror film called Season of the Witch, everyone would either love it or not doesn't know it exists.
I disagree with that statement. I think a lot of people...
You're not a horror fan, so...
I think a lot of people's issues with Halloween 3 is that it was not a very well-done movie. It capitalized on a franchise that it really had nothing to do with. That terrible jingle that would make anyone homicidal. And
You're going to need to watch a whole lot more 80s horror films to make that call.
You mean they get worse than Sleepaway Camp?
Oh, yes.
All right. When you get down to slugs, you're going to be wishing for Sleepaway Camp and Halloween 3. Because those are beloved by many person in the horror community. No one gives a shit about slugs.
Yeah, I don't even think I've seen that one, to be honest.
Yeah. Hey, same.
You know, watch Contamination. No, go ahead.
It's not my least favorite genre by a long shot. There's a lot of it I like. I think where I have issues with it is sometimes I feel like the story itself is actually sacrificed for like cheap entertainment, and that's fine. I mean,
you're not wrong about a lot of it.
Yeah, but my point still stands is that there are films that have become classics over the years, and then there is a whole bunch of crap that is all direct to video, or you know, sometimes it did go to the theaters, but is not as beloved, and that's why I would my comparison for this to Halloween 2 is because it's the outlier in the franchise.
It's the outlier.
Yeah,
one of those. It really doesn't quite fit with the other ones, even though I do enjoy it. Yeah. It's one of those. You could definitely watch this movie separate from the rest of the series.
Yeah, but I also think that from about 1980 to about 1989, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we could show Sammy, and she would go, "Oh God, please turn on Sleepaway Camp."
I agree.
At least Freddy was in the film.
Yeah, he definitely was in the movie.
But we had Tom Atkins in Halloween 3, so.
Because I was one of those, I first hit Halloween 3, and the more it's gone on, I do have an appreciation for it.
Yeah. And I am not the only person that has the opinion that if it wasn't called Halloween 3, the film would may not have as big of a fan base, but it wouldn't have the hate that it does, since it was, I think, a brave failure of a film, because kudos to them for trying something different, and we know that it worked out so well, considering part 4 was called The Return of Michael Myers.
Yeah, and I
agree. We told you in the subtitle that Michael Myers is back.
Leave us alone.
Well, yeah, and I mean, no, I'm not going to fault them for trying. I will say that. Yeah. But I mean, what did you expect? You took a beloved franchise and you thought, let's try and make this film without the character that is
what they were trying to do is trying to Well, they were trying to tell other horror stories centered around the holiday of Halloween. So, because they considered the end of Halloween 2 the death of Michael Myers. And it makes me wonder what the other ideas they might have had were. But we know that Season of the Witch was just so rejected by so many people. The Akkad's course corrected and gave us another sort of classic before giving us two of the worst, but not necessarily the worst entries in the franchise, but we're not talking about Halloween.
Well, that's our thing. We tend to go on tangents.
I know. So how excited were we whenever Robert Ressler showed back up in the film, since, you know, we just saw him a couple weeks ago?
I forgot he was in this movie.
I reminded y'all on the episode that he's in this movie,
but again, I slept since then. And when we watched it, it's like, oh yeah, I forgot he's in this movie. Yeah. I thought he was really good in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
At first you think he's like, well, great. This is going to be a guy that's going to be a complete asshole to him the whole movie. And that lasts for like maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah, and that is kind of the cliche of like how sometimes men can become, you know, get into it and then become like buds for the, you know, for the rest of at least one of them's life.
True.
And there are sometimes you think that Jesse's being bullied, and like whenever he falls asleep in class and the snake does just somehow appear on him. I don't know how it does, whether it's Freddy or someone in class, but even at the end of it, Jesse's laughing about the snake.
Oh yeah. And they thought it was all hilarious.
Mm-hmm. And
I didn't get the impression that he was like misunderstood or not popular or particularly unliked.
Well,
I think he was just kind of a big average normal kid.
Well, I mean, he's getting picked on a little bit for being the new kid, because he and the Walshes are new to Springwood.
There's a lot of flirting in this movie.
Yeah,
I do get that. Mm-hmm. It's one of those. Yeah. It's probably not the direction he definitely wouldn't have taken it.
No, and also even back then he was just like, I don't see the point in making another one, and he wouldn't for 5 more films.
Yeah.
How's my math?
It's good.
Yeah. Though he did contribute to the story on the third one, and I think that is what kind of helped make it, found that balance that we were looking for in Freddy, where he's starting to have the one-liners, but he's still fucking scary.
True.
Yeah, and you know, Craven was right. You know, as the films went along, they were about the special effects. I mean, the big set piece here is Freddy transitioning out of Freddy, or Freddy transitioning out of Jesse in Grady's room, because that was a massive set piece. And then the third one has quite a few. Is it the fourth one that has the Roach Motel?
Yeah, it does have the Roach Motel in it.
Yeah.
So I will not be watching the one.
No, you will be eventually.
It's not exactly what you're thinking.
I'm quite sure that it's worse. Okay, so I kind of have a question for y'all. This is something that I think about with these films, and this may just be my personal opinion, but I'm curious what y'all's is. Four of the major horror classic villains, I guess you want to call them. I honestly think that, they're all good, and they all have their own, I guess they all have their own merits and things that people love about them. I think strictly from a like creative standpoint, that Freddy and Ghostface are better. They're more complex. And they're more interesting. Well, like, don't get me wrong, Michael Myers is interesting, and Jason, I guess, is too. But they're just regular people. They have a story, and it's interesting and all. But I don't know. I think Freddy is really, really well thought out. It's well crafted. It's unique. What he's capable of, it's completely different. And then Ghostface is never the same person. It's almost like Ghostface isn't really a person. It's a
philosophy. I don't even know.
It's a philosophy. It's a legend that people jump in and out of.
Yeah. The only thing about your statement that I would say you're slightly wrong on is Jason and Michael Myers are not ordinary people. They start off sort of, but Jason kind of gets. Jason's technically a zombie by a certain point.
By the sixth one, he's a zombie.
Yeah. And Michael Myers,
we don't even know.
He's either the true embodiment. Well, depending on which timeline you're going on, he's either the victim of a cult, just pure evil, or, you know,
just an unstoppable.
Or really, those are the only two.
That's really it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I partially agree with you, Sam, because
Freddy Krueger has always been one of my favorites because he has a personality. Mm-hmm. Even though there are a couple movies that are just god awful and they mishandle him completely.
Well, and I'd even argue that Jason has a personality, but it took seven movies and for Kane Hodder to bring one to him.
He does have a personality, but it's one of those, honestly, you can kind of switch him out because you're going to realize who's playing him by his body movements. Because Kane Hodder has a completely different way of moving than any other actor did. I disagree on the Ghostface thing because I find it's one of those like, it could be anybody, but most of the time I find the reveals to be kind of stupid. Except for like maybe the first one and the new one. All the other ones I'm just like, I don't care.
I thought the reveal in the second one was good.
I know you do. I was just like, okay, I think...
like anything, I think that there's the potential there that they have mishandled Ghostface some, but I just feel like what they created with that original is, I don't want to say unbeatable, but was very, very unique.
Well, and what makes Ghostface scarier I'll even give you, like, scarier than latter day Michael Myers or, you know, some of the Jason sequels is because Ghostface is a human. Ghostface is someone you know. That is far more terrifying than sorry to spoil part of Nightmare 4. You know, that's scarier than, like, a dog pissing on a skeleton in a junkyard and suddenly someone's back to life. I wish I would made that up.
No, I get that because he can be anybody. It could be like some other psychopath that decides, hey, I'm going to do this because I thought I was inspired by it.
Yeah.
That could actually happen, as ridiculous as those movies get.
Yeah. And we are naturally more enamored by the human monster because if we weren't, we wouldn't have 87 true crime podcasts that I'm completely ignoring and have no intention of ever listening to because there's so fucking many of them. And also, nothing's going to top Serial Season 1. But, and what's cool about Freddy is he was a real person. He was a real killer. And he became something else. He was a real threat.
He was a real threat, and he became something that you could never escape.
Yeah. Jason was a boy that was just not looked after by camp counselors, and his mom's the one that went nuts. And that's part of why I love the first Friday the 13th, is because it's not Jason, it's someone else. It is a true whodunit.
Yeah, and she was a human person. Like, I think he was kind of human in the first two.
At least in the second one, I can make the argument that he is someone that's been living out in the woods. But by the end of the third one, there's got to be something else going on.
He gets an axe to the face.
Yeah. Definitely by the end of the fourth one, he's not human anymore because his head does kind of travel down a machete.
Yes.
I feel like you could kind of say the same thing about Michael Myers, but...
Sure. Well, Michael Myers is, you know, so different because we technically never truly know what caused him to snap as a young child to become an unstoppable killing machine. Some movies, I'm not kidding whenever I say it's a curse placed on him by a cult, but, you know, like the new trilogy and Rob Zombie's films, they're just trying to make him out to be another human monster in one way or another. Or at least in this new trilogy, they're trying to explore what he is. And I think that's also kind of what made Michael Myers scary, is because he too was a human.
Yeah, and you don't know why he does what he does. He has no motivation.
Yeah, except for the Rob Zombie movies, you know.
They're kind of, yeah.
He was an unshowered redneck whose mom stripped.
Which is why to date, next to It, When a Stranger Calls is still the most terrifying thing I've ever sat through, because it plays on a completely real fear that absolutely could happen to anybody.
Well, that and The Strangers.
Yeah, Strangers is another one.
Oh, The Descent.
You said what it's trying.
I mean, not all of The Descent, but part of what the audience of The Descent is it did pick out very real fears that people have and played on those.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, there's aspects of it that could have happened, but none of those films are the one that I watched.
No, but I mean, there's not a lot to this movie. There is and there isn't, and also we're making points that this genre, you know, sometimes raises.
Well, and honestly, I don't feel like you can talk about some of these horror movies without talking about other ones, because
yeah.
I think there's just so much influence within the genre.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course.
Are y'all ready to... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. Because all these things came around in the same kind of decade, mostly. Yeah. Most of them did.
Yeah, and also Shakespeare said there's only 7 stories anyway.
That's true.
Are y'all ready to move to our segments?
Yeah, why not? Let's get nuts.
All right, well, John already alluded to it, so let's start with our first and favorite. Did John like the soundtrack?
No.
As fabulous as it was.
No, John does not. And in fact, what's funny about the Elm Street franchise is the third one, which is my favorite, has iconic, memorable music. The Dokken theme song is always memorable. And then you had the Fat Boys doing their song. They had Will Smith did Nightmare on Elm Street. So,
fun fact about the Will Smith Nightmare on Elm Street, it's mm-hmm. heavily inspired from the second one.
Yeah. But I like I said earlier, I rewatched both the first and this film last night, just because it had been a while since I've seen the first film, and I kind of wanted to be able to draw comparisons when possible. And oh god, if there is a pop or rock song in either of those two films, they're all terrible.
They're definitely the we could not get rights.
Yeah. I think some of these were written for the film, because the first film has the song at the end credits, like, it's a nightmare, it's just a dream, it's a dream. It's like, god, this is terrible.
Yeah.
Why does this exist? So the answer is no, because the music for these films, well, not every song is a banger. It did get so much better in the next century.
All right.
Although I will give a shout out to the score that Christopher Young wrote. Christopher Young also did the music for the first Hellraiser movie. And I like what he does. I thought the music he created was very atmospheric and helped the film. I, you know, not so much for Touch Me All Night Long by Fonda Rae.
So, with our next segment, I have no idea. Rotten Tomatoes was not in existence when this came out. So, does it have a score? Did they go back?
Oh, well, yeah. A lot of critics will rate films from all different years, and if they're Rotten Tomatoes certified, that's going to factor in. And I feel that's going to skew what the Rotten Tomatoes score is now, but I'm going to base it on, even though I could not find a Roger Ebert or a Gene Siskel review for this film, knowing what I know about them and the critics of that era, I'm going to base my guess on what I think they said. Okay. So that being said, I'm going to assume the critical score was about, I'm going to give it an 18.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to give it a 34.
Oh, wow. Well, Sammy was the closest. Mm-hmm. It actually has 20 reviews that's certified on Rotten Tomatoes. It has a 41%.
Okay, so the youngin' critics have elevated this film.
Yeah, like you said, it's definitely mixed. I think even the ones that are kind of the ones that really don't like it are not really saying it's awful or anything. They're just saying it's just not as good as the first one, or saying that it's uneven and everything. As like, but it's like you said, it's
it's more favorably reviewed now than probably what it would have been right then if Rotten Tomatoes existed. Because your 18% would have been probably very accurate.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I was very surprised I couldn't find anything from Gene or Raj on this film.
I think there was a certain point where they stopped reviewing certain one.
Well, after a while, because there's a really cool YouTube channel I found that has full episodes of Siskel and Ebert and Ebert and Roper.
Mm-hmm.
And one of which is the notorious one that is essentially them just sitting and bitching about horror films and how shitty and how horrible they are for like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's where Cinema Snob got the personality that Brad brought into that character, because he was trying to do a parody of Siskel and Ebert doing their review of, I think it was Friday 5.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I was looking far and wide for the... I bet this movie got a shellacking from them, and I couldn't find anything, like, even in print.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, and I also looked for you, Joseph, no Armand White.
Oh, thank Christ.
Review. We're going to find something from him eventually.
Oh, I'm sure we will. Yeah. Okay, what do y'all
think? Sammy, if you don't, real quick, Sammy, if you don't know, Armand White is a film critic that got, he kind of became persona non grata in all the critic circles, and he is the asshole that caused Toy Story 3 to not have a perfect 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, yep, y'all are both pretty wrong. It's at a 33%.
Oh, well, okay then.
Oh, wow.
Because looking at the reviews, there are people that really like this movie or really hate this movie.
So I'm the one outlier. Oh, spoiler alert from how I feel. That is just like, yeah, it's okay.
I think I'm on the count. I don't love it, but I do really like it.
Yeah.
So right. I feel like I already know the answer to our next segment, which is, does this film pass the Bechdel test?
All right, what do you think the answer is? Joseph, do you agree or disagree?
I'm going to say no, because I'm struggling to think of... What? No. No, I think it does.
Well, according to BechdelTest.com, where is my first go-to for answering the question, did this film pass the Bechdel test, and thus proving how truly meaningless the Bechdel test is. It really kind of is, I'm sorry to say. But this movie passed 3 out of 3 tests.
You're kidding.
Nope. Lisa and Carrie talked to each other on several occasions, but always talked about Jesse. So we have multiple named female characters. Cherry and Angela talked to each other on 2 occasions at the first breakfast scene. Cheryl asks, Angie, what are you up to? And Angela answers, I'm trying to get the Fu Man fingers. And at the second breakfast scene, Jesse tells his family about the old dwellers, and Angela says, Mom, I'm scared. And she said, oh, honey, it's all right. Those bare minimum. And you know, I don't want to insult what Alison Bechdel created whenever she developed this test, but that's why they say this is a good start and not necessarily the be-all, end-all, because... It is so insanely easy to pass this by doing fuck all, basically. But we're going to continue to do this because eventually something's not going to pass.
And I bet you that one movie's going to surprise us. Like, how the hell did this not pass this?
Yeah.
All
some
right.
Kind of
well,
technicality.
I guess that brings us to our final segments. So,
before we do this, I got a question for you, Sammy. Does this have a creepy or chromantic? Because I feel if any film's going to qualify, it's this one.
Yeah.
I mean, not really, just because it's all creepy.
I think it's a little chromantic that Lisa just rolls with the fact that, you know, her fella is... is a little obsessed with the people he killed.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's that.
Yeah.
You could only wish to have such a supportive girlfriend like her.
Yeah. It's just like,
I mean, no, if your girlfriend doesn't stand by you when there's a possibility that you're a serial killer, is she truly that loyal?
She's like, I might have killed quite a few people. You know, who hasn't? You know, yeah. I love you.
We're just going to burn this shirt.
That's what the cops will be looking for.
All right. So for everyone's favorite segment, do y'all have best line, worst line?
Oh, do I?
I feel like almost every line in this film qualifies for both.
They do. Who wants to go first?
I think that the best line, the truly best line, almost qualifies for "You Can't Handle the Truth" / "You Pancake Eating Motherfucker" award, and that's Freddy's "You've Got the Body and I've Got the Brains."
That is one of the best ones, I have to agree. Yeah. I have a couple. I think most of them are in the pole scene. Where he goes like, "You are all my children now." I've always loved that.
Yeah. It was done, I would argue, done better in the seventh film.
I agree. Yes, I do agree with that. But also, one that just makes me laugh. This one guy's trying to calm him down. He goes, "Just tell us what you want, all right? I'm here to help." He goes, "Help yourself, fucker."
I think that character known as the do-gooder in the credits, that qualified for one of my worst films because it's like, He's like trying to calm down the dog. It's growling. It's like, "It's okay, buddy. So we're here to help you. You know, it's going to be okay. We're not going to hurt you," to the man with knives on his fingers.
That's equivalent to in Jason X, like he wanted his machete back.
Now that is a self-aware line. Because that is why I love Jason X. It is a dumb movie, and it knows it. So it just says, "Fuck it, let's go for it," and it does.
What did you think about the biology teacher's line where he's like, "Want to play with the animals, Mr. Walsh? Join the circus."
I mean, it's no better or worse than every other line in this movie, if we're honest. There is so much. There's so much dialogue in this film that feels like the writer was high-fiving himself, like, "This is gold." Like, it's aluminum at best.
I thought of another one I really like. It's his sister. She's like, "Mommy, why can't JC wake up like everybody else?"
I do have to give props to not the very first scene, but, like, pretty much the start of this film is him screaming uncontrollably from upstairs and his family looking around like that's completely normal.
It's like same shit every day. Which again raises one the problem.
Which I mean, it's kind of bad, but it's also funny. Where he goes, Jesse's talking to Ron. He said, "Hey, Greg, did you remember your dreams?" And he goes, "Only the wet ones."
Yeah.
I mean, it's a cheap shot, but it works.
Well, I mean, there's so many lines in this movie that are great, equally great and terrible on that level. Like, you know, where Jesse's like, "There's somebody trying to get in my body." And Grady's like, "Yeah, and she's over in the pool house and you want to sleep with me."
All right. So for our second to last segment, do y'all have anything for the good, bad, and the ugly?
How dumb is the pool party?
It is dumb, but I love it.
I think that's the perfect description for this movie. It is so dumb, but I love it. Because it's just, there's the cliche of the high school party, and then this is the dumb one. Because the parents, they're cooking, playing Benny Goodman, and then mom drags dad off to bed, and then the obvious the debauchery begins.
The moment they leave, they're like, "What are they doing?" I was like, "What do you think?"
Yeah. And the
idea that they turned off the lights and then all of a sudden they're not going to hear you turn up the music and start cheering.
They did hear it.
No, I know. I'm just saying, that's what's so stupid about it.
Yeah. Well, and the dad tries to get out of bed and go check on him, and mom's like, nope. It's like they're encouraging it almost.
It's like she's like, no.
I just feel like teenagers are not that dumb.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. I was one. I'm not going to say I was the brightest. I know this is a different podcast thing, but I have an unanswerable question of what is the time gap between the pool party and the last scene in the movie? Also, her best friend, her first line on the bus is great party lease, which means she's either being sarcastic and we can't tell, or they're acting like a bunch of their fellow classmates didn't just get murdered in one of them's backyard. Which also raises the question, did that even happen?
I'm wondering if it's, I was thinking it's that whole sequence is a dream at the very end.
Yeah, because I mean, it has that dreamlike quality at the end of the they had at the end of the first film.
Yeah, because just like the first one ends. Because it has that shock.
Oh, meaning that entire sequence of him getting on the bus is a dream. Because I buy that.
Yeah. Which
I think that makes the most sense.
Well, if that's a dream, where is Jesse? Is he in an institution somewhere? Is he in prison? Because he did just kill a bunch of people.
But remember, like I said, I think that's the beauty of what happened at the pool party. That pool party is full of witnesses that didn't see Jesse kill anybody. The assumption being that they saw Freddy kill people.
But this is also a town that, A, killed Freddy and kind of covered that up to spare the children. And now it could be the town just to be like, no, you didn't see Freddy. You saw Jesse.
Well, and if you think, I know Sammy hasn't watched the later movie, but all the cops are kind of in on it. Like, we'll just cover this up.
Yeah, there's this really great TV show I saw that handled that very well.
The way you say that makes it sound like they didn't.
Sir, you've seen the same episode of Freddy's Nightmares that I have.
They're really bad.
Yeah. Sammy, you may not know this, but in the late 80s, early 90s, they made a Tales from the Crypt ripoff show called Freddy's Nightmares that was hosted by Freddy Krueger. But only like 2 to 3 episodes of the show actually dealt with Freddy Krueger.
Did you say
almost
late 80s? Yeah,
I know you weren't alive. That was sarcasm. And also, there was a Friday the 13th TV series that didn't feature Jason
at all.
I think in the final episode, they were supposed to tie it in by one of the relics they find being Jason's mask, but I think the series was canceled before it ever got to that point.
I think what happened is they looked at the overwhelming success of Halloween 3, and they thought, we don't need our signature character in order to succeed.
Actually, this thing called syndication had just been invented, and someone said, hey, let's make a TV series, and no one stopped them.
That's true.
The difference between Friday the 13th, the series, and Freddy's Nightmares is one of those shows had money. I'll let you guess which one.
All right.
It's not the one you want it to be.
I feel like this week's big question might actually not be a given.
Let's find out.
I think it's pretty predictable. But
yeah. Well, unlike do-gooders at the pool party, Joseph, Sammy, did you survive A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge?
I'm curious to hear what Sammy has to say, because I really don't know if she survived or not.
Actually, before we answer this question, what revenge did Freddy take? Because wasn't that what he was doing in the first film?
Yes, I survived. This is the kind of thing that I think, this is where campy is good. You know, we've had some exposure to that on the show with Sleepaway Camp and Tammy and T-Rex, and you know, I know Black Christmas wasn't exactly supposed to be campy, but it was a slasher film. When they do films like this, I feel like a couple of different outcomes can happen. One, they can be boring, like Black Christmas. Sorry, John.
It's okay. Two, you can just sit there and be wrong.
They can just be utterly stupid, like Sleepaway Camp. This captured all the best elements. You know, it was watchable. The story was kind of fun. The characters are interesting. Is it a perfect or flawless movie? Absolutely not. Is it one I will probably pick up on a regular basis and watch? No, not really. But also, was it fun? Did I enjoy myself? Did I regret the hour and a half I spent watching it? No.
All right. Joseph?
Of course, I survived this movie. That's my fourth favorite in the franchise. So it's one of those... I can watch it anytime. It's not one of those I can just. It's one of those I can just throw on. And I don't have to really pay attention to it. I know what's going on. I've seen this multiple times, and I can probably repeat it line for line when it comes on.
Okay. So is it my turn now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is this film good? No, I would say this is not a good movie. Is this film entertaining? Yes, absolutely. And because of that, that's why I survived. I think that... So I do agree with all of the Freddy fans that say this film got so much wrong. But I also appreciate the camp nature of this. I mean, this is probably a better film on some level than Mommy Dearest. But I like the fact that... All these years later, what was probably thrown at this movie as an insult, you know, that it's a gay horror film, is now the reason so many people love this film. And, you know, if I'm going to love The Room, and I think, and I know Sammy's going to roll her eyes and disagree with me, but I think films like Sleepaway Camp are technically better films because at least it was cohesive. It had, you know, it actually Sleepaway Camp was setting up the rules for them to be broken by the two sequels. But I think this movie is fun to watch, especially in like a group setting where, you know, like The Room, you just make people watch it just to see their reaction. I'm kind of like Joseph. This is one I can watch almost anytime just because like we've both seen this movie so many times. There's you can it's like watching it on autopilot. So.
Oh, yeah. And especially like the a lot of the effects do still hold up fairly well.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell that whenever Freddy's coming out of Jesse's body, it's, you know, switched from to a dummy. But I mean, that comes with the territory.
Oh, yeah. Especially in a horror film with a low budget.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I've watched Evil Dead 2 1,000 times. We can still tell whenever the girl's head becomes a prop, but doesn't mean we love it any less.
No, and like, of course, there's many mistakes in that movie, but it's still a great movie. I love
it. I'd say there's more mistakes in the first Evil Dead, but those people were trying just to not freeze to death in a cabin in, what was it, Tennessee?
Yeah, and they had barely any money for that movie.
Yeah, the fact that those people survived that movie, literally, is kind of a miracle. I'm surprised no one's tried to make that movie, like the movie about the making of the Evil Dead.
I think they've been trying to, but I don't think it's ever really materialized. Because I've always thought the whole story of how it got made was very interesting.
Yeah.
All I can say is I'm extremely grateful that you are not making me watch The Evil Dead 2 next week.
Damn.
Well, The Evil Dead 2 doesn't qualify. And also, Evil Dead 2 is a better movie than the movie we just watched, but is it a better movie than the one next week? Joseph, because we both share an appreciation for this film, why don't you tell them what we're watching next week?
We're watching, what is it, 97 that it came out, I think?
97, 98, somewhere in there, I think.
Yeah. It's a comedy classic called But I'm a Cheerleader, starring Natasha Lyonne.
Yeah, this week was for the gays, next week is for the lesbians, and I believe our friend Mark is going to come back and revel in this one.
Oh, I don't think I've been on an episode with Mark in a while.
Yeah, you keep abandoning Sammy.
Things just did not work out at times.
Yeah, you having some kind of life or some shit.
Yeah, life tends to get in the way.
Yeah. Life gets in the way. All right, so do we have any shout-outs this week?
No, for me.
Even though I'm an episode behind, Obi-Wan Kenobi is starting out pretty good.
Yeah, I can't believe there's a Star Wars series that, A, I'm actually watching it, and B, I'm ahead of you.
I know. It's really weird.
Yeah. We'll get to next week, and something will happen, and I won't get to it, and by the time I know it, you'll have finished the entire series, and I'll just be like, I'll get to it eventually.
So is episode 3 better than the first two episodes?
I think a little, just because a certain character's in it, and certain actors with that character, and he's not quite Rogue One badass, but there's some badasses to it. Oh, have you seen the trailer yet for the Andor series yet?
I haven't watched the trailer yet. Is it good?
Oh, it looks so good.
Which really makes me happy, because even somebody that's been a defender of the new Star Wars stuff, it's been a little hit and miss with their series.
It's brave of you to say that on the internet.
Yeah, I'm the only one that's going to call this out.
Yeah. No, Andor looks really good. And I'll second the Obi-Wan is great.
Yeah, I'm curious to see where it goes.
All right, so on my personal Facebook page, since we're recording on June 1st, which is the first day of Pride, I decided every day for the month of June, I'm going to try to highlight an LGBT artist or band, and I'm going to try to stay away from the typical ones. Like, I'm probably not going to rep Pet Shop Boys or Judas Priest. I'm really internally struggling on whether or not I'm going to feature songs by Against Me or Brandi Carlile, whose birthday is today. Happy birthday, Brandi Carlile. You're not listening to this show, but a boy can dream. But I kind of want to do the same thing this week, and I'm going to give a shout out to the band We Are the Union. They are a fourth wave ska band. Ska never really went away. It just, you know, we just got rid of all the, you know, knockoffs and goofy bullshit. But they are fronted by a trans woman, and their trombone player is non-binary. And their most recent album, oh, I should have thought about this before I started talking. I'm obviously going to cut all this. But their most recent album, Ordinary Life, it did draw a lot of inspiration about this from the singer's transition, and it's just really cool to hear, you know, new good ska happening in the 22nd or whatever century we're in. We are in the 22nd, right? Or 21st. God damn, I need to go to bed. I'm just gonna leave in there that I'm a fucking idiot. But anyway, check out We Are the Union. And also, if you are a ska fan at all, on the aforementioned Tubi, there is the documentary Pick It Up, which is a history of 90s ska. And it does get into the complete history of ska, its original roots, and what it evolved into before it became, what does that meme say? The sound a 13-year-old boy hears in his head before mozzarella sticks come out. Because it's so much more than that, and so yeah, so I'm gonna try to do like a different genre. Like I've already done ska, so that kind of takes punk off. So maybe next week I'll do country, because there's a shitload of gay country out there.
Sammy would have appreciated that.
Yeah, there's actually a really cool website, Country Queer. I'll give them a shout out probably again next week, but. They cover specifically country artists from the LGBT community, and quite a bit of it is good. So, listeners, thank y'all for putting up with our shenanigans for one more week. Happy Pride Month, everyone. Please stay safe. You know, celebrate accordingly, but also, you know, be careful out there, because, you know, this world is still kind of shitty. And Joseph, Sammy, thank y'all for doing one more episode. Until then, you know. I guess I got the body and y'all got the brains, because Mine's shut down. Mine is shut the fuck down.
Surviving Chick Flicks is brought to you by the Circle of Jug. The show is edited by John, and all clips used are the property of their copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and leave us a 5-star rating at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get the show. If there's anything you would like us to cover on the show, or just drop us a line at survivingchickflicks@gmail.com. The show is copyright 2022, Circle of Jug Productions, all rights reserved.